This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballerman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballerman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 19. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Ridian Lewis, co-founder and CEO of RateSetter. They formed in 2010 with the innovation of a provision fund, and their aim is to be simple and safe. One of RateSetter's proud claims to fame is that no one has lost a penny on their site. I touch wood at this point, although RateSetter touched their provision fund, which we'll discuss later. Originally, I had intended this show to be centred on the many changes in UK P2P in 2015, but in researching P2P, by which I mean reading all of the leading websites, it certainly gave me a headache over a few days, I just couldn't find any hardcore content, as it were. Plenty of titillating softcore stuff, but nothing showing you how it's actually done. Practically speaking, we all read things in the media like P2P disintermediates the banks, or P2P directly connects borrower and lender, etc. Now, these things are kind of indicative or metaphorical, but they're not always literally true. The real truth is locked up in the actual cash flows and contracts. As an example, despite reading masses of stuff last year about Lending Club pre its IPO, it was only this year that I stumbled on the fact that Lending Club doesn't do the lending. The actual loan is made by WebBank, headquartered in Salt Lake City, which is then assigned. Now, to non-FS folks, this may sound like hair-splitting, tiny distinctions of no real practicality. At one level, the frothy-slash-popular-slash-my-mum level, it is. Tech background folk can think of it in a similar way to an error in a line of code. It could have a massively non-linear impact. FS background folk will know by experience that the devil is in the detail. It's the tiny fissures in the cliff that years later may lead to a collapse. Hence the shuffle of this episode into being a deep dive. In passing, it's not just P2P that this overly soft porn content affects. Amazingly, after LFP003, a deep dive into how digital currencies actually work, I had a few folks feedback that we'd got it wrong. No, we hadn't. The general blog slash press stuff slash understanding is all too often just misleading, inaccurate, or in some cases, plain wrong. Anyway, I have the ideal guest today to dive into the detail. Ridian is not just the co-founder of RateSetter, but also an ex-Lazard corporate financier, so has plenty of old-school experience of the devil residing in the detail and the need to chase him away. So let's get on with the show. Hi, Ridian. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning, Mike.
So, as I was mentioning, you, like me, used to have a job where we wore ties that yes. We seem to have given up. What led you from being in a well-established firm and thinking of setting out into the great blue yonder yourself?
Well, actually, after university, my first job, proper job, was at a company called Betfair, which is a peer-to-peer betting exchange.
LinkedIn let me down.
It predated Lazard. So at around that time, it was 2002, 2003, companies that were taking on the world were things like Betfair and eBay. So the concept of peer-to-peer was changing certain industries. I worked there and I found it very interesting, excited by the idea back then, this was in 2002, of whether peer-to-peer could ever be applied to money.
Interesting.
So that was a long time ago.
So you were ahead of the game then?
I think I was. The whole thing's about implementation, not...
No, indeed. I was just trying to think of when I heard of peer-to-peer, but it would be Napster, of course, which is genuinely peer-to-peer
file
from a computer
sharing
science perspective. Exactly. When was that? Was that the 90s or was that the early 2000s as well?
Yeah, early 2000s, yeah, I guess.
It was around the sort of the dot-commy thing, wasn't it? Going back to that, I certainly don't remember anybody talking about Napster file sharing having anything to do with money.
Yeah, so that was in 2002, and I actually wrote a couple of pages on it, which I shared with my brother, and they never saw the light of day other than that, and I wish I'd kept them, funny enough, because I'm sure...
And your brother wasn't a friend of a guy called Zuper Giles?
No, he wasn't. I'd love to have kept them, because I'm sure they were incredibly sort of naive and idealistic at that time. So that was in 2002, and then I left Betfair and applied for jobs in the city, and I got a job on the graduate scheme at Lazard, and to cut a long story short, I was there for 7 years. You join as a generalist, but after about 3 or 4 years, you join a sort of specific sector team, and I joined their FIG team, so their financial institutions team, which is very good. Lazard has a very good practice in that financial institutions because banks are very relaxed about having Lazard around advising them because Lazard is not a bank. It's an advisory firm. whereas a lot of the other advisors also have banking arms. So Lazard has a very good franchise in advising banks and insurance companies. So I was in that team, and I always used to say to my colleagues that I thought one day peer-to-peer lending would break through. Obviously, we'd seen Zopa launch in 2005, and they always used to think, they'd yawn and they'd go, you're mad. And there was some truth in that. It was tiny. It wasn't really...
People said that to me a year ago. Oh, it's going nowhere, you know.
So it'd always been in my mind, and I was always keen to do it. And then two things, really, to be precise as to what sort of propelled me to do it, is in August 2009, I met somebody who said that they could build the tech.
I write someone to do all the hard work. You draw on the whiteboard and they turn it into computer code.
Yeah, indeed. So that really made me determined to do it. I felt that there was a massive opportunity. And I'd seen firsthand through the work we were doing at Lazard just quite what a muddle the banks were in.
Yeah.
And so this felt like an opportunity of a lifetime. And it just, if I'm very honest, it just welled up and it just wouldn't go away. And I kept trying to convince myself that it was the wrong thing, but it kept on telling me that it was the right thing to do. So anyway, I then sort of did some moonlighting, if you like, where I was working during the day, but also trying to pull together a business case in the evenings. And then it got to a point whereby I was actually having to go to meetings on the business case. And I wanted to go and see like credit reference agencies.
So you're kind of doing it in the classic sidepreneur way.
Yeah.
You didn't make the mistake that I made in 1998, which is I gave up working for Kleinwort Benson, and you know, the last day I was still working for Kleinwort Benson. And then a bit later I met the Lord Rockley, who was chairman of Kleinwort Benson at the various point in time. And he said, Mike, so how many clients do you line up beforehand? I said, oh, I didn't line up any. Well, that was naive, wasn't it? I then spent 12 months lining them up that I could have done it beforehand. But I mean, one thing which is worth flagging up for non-FS people, coming back to the corporate finance thing, given the reputation of the city and yada, 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 which hasn't always gone very well the last few years, is that, and certainly was the case at Kleinwort as well, is that certainly in the blue chip corporate finance departments, reputation was everything. So you had a background of actually you want to do things properly. You're not trying to screw people because the world goes around.
No, I mean, I personally, as an individual, I mean, I find the scepticism quite demoralising sometimes because, I mean, what can one say? I mean, I'm doing this because I think it's the right thing to do and because I think that there's an opportunity to actually improve what savers and borrowers can get. That is actually what motivates me, and it's what I hope now motivates people across RateSetter. You can actually feel it here, that in the DNA, I hope, of the business, and things will develop, but is a genuine belief that we are doing something that's good. And that's incredibly important because culture is vital.
Absolutely.
And the scepticism that people have can be quite wearing, but of course I completely understand it because there are
plenty of examples of things that didn't go very well.
Absolutely.
A few years ago, but I entirely agree about the fact that one of the interesting things to me about peer-to-peer, it's not just that it's sort of in motion and the companies are growing, which in itself is exciting and interesting, but actually that potentially it is of service to society as a whole, and also it's something that everybody can interact with. So if you've got excess cash, you should certainly look at putting some of your cash through a peer-to-peer platform, and vice versa. If you need some money, whether you're an individual or a corporate, you should certainly look at it. So it's got that benefit. So maybe this is a good time to move on, really, and into what I'm calling sort of beyond the metaphors. So starting at a relatively high level then, what is a peer-to-peer as such? I mean, what are the key components in a peer-to-peer generically?
If you strip it down, I would say that the generic characteristic is that the ultimate risk lies with the lender. As to how the contract between the lender and the borrower works, you will see it's quite a sort of varied landscape. So if you had to really boil it down, it is that ultimately the risk lies with the lender, which is fundamentally different to a bank.
Absolutely. And let's take a simple example. Well, let's just dive straight into this metaphorical whiteboard. He says, wishing that it wasn't an audio podcast at once, because then we could scribble. But even if we could, nobody can read my writing, including myself, so that may not help. Let's just use RateSetter as an example, and you can sort of point out where different platforms may do things differently. So at a very metaphorical level, I can come onto your site today, I can sort of put £1,000 in for a year or whatever, and then metaphorically speaking, you're disintermediating the banks and I'm directly connected to the lenders and money flows back to me and hopefully it all goes well. And let's not touch on the provision fund for the moment. So that's fine. So I've got the big picture, it's kind of schematic thing. But what actually happens? So one of the things about disintermediation is that it's not really disintermediating banks. And one of the problems here with vocabulary is that a bank does many, many things. You're disintermediating the consumer lending department, but you're not disintermediating the bank account department, because money, as most people sort of seem to forget now and then, is nothing other than bits in bank computers, shall we say. So money through a peer-to-peer platform will always basically be going from one bank account to another bank account to another bank account to another bank account and flows like that. So what actually happens at that level?
So absolutely, this is, I mean, when people talk about disintermediating the banking system, to be more precise, what they're doing is this is a challenge to the core activity of lending and borrowing, which is just one of the things that a bank does. I completely agree with you. Others are beginning to challenge them on a payment side, but that's just not what we do in peer-to-peer lending. You're absolutely right. So when you come to RateSetter as a lender, you put your £1,000 in. That actually goes to our client account.
A combined client account?
Yeah, it's a combined client account, which is heavily regulated by the client money rules.
Someone like Barclays or something?
That's with Barclays, as it happens. I mean, it could be with other banks, but it happens to be with Barclays, who are very positive towards dealing with the likes of RateSetter. And then the borrower comes and is approved and takes out the loan, so that the money would travel from your account.
Yeah.
Let's say you bank with NatWest, into Barclays, yep. And then it would go to the borrower's account, which might be with Santander. So it is not leaving the banking system. It's the money flows, I think, that is the most important element of banking. And I think that's why I think they're quite relaxed, if I'm honest, about peer-to-peer lending, is because the money's still flowing within their system.
Yeah, that's what I was saying before. You can't get money outside a bank other than these little bits of paper in a pocket, which aren't many of them anyway.
All peer-to-peer lending is doing is we are changing the handshake, as I call it. So previously, the handshake would be between the borrower and the bank. It is now between the borrower and the lender. But the money all flows within the system.
Good. OK, so I've got that. And then just going back to cash flows, again, just keeping this very simple, and we'll get onto some of the other issues in a minute. So going back to cash flows, then let's hope that my borrower is a good one and he pays me back each month some interest and a little bit of principal. And then eventually all the money's come back to my bank account with interest, and you've taken a little fee off in the meantime, which is fine. So the one thing that I haven't seen discussed is the kind of legal slash contractual thing. Because again, my problem with the idea of directly connecting the lending and the borrower is that it may work on corporate lending or something like that, which I understand you guys do a little bit these days as well as the consumer. But I thought with consumer, because of data protection and what I saw very prosaically described as baseball bat risk, that actually you don't tell me it's Mr. Bloggs, the Coleman or whatever, because of data protection, in case I go around there and say, oi, mate, with my baseball bat.
No, we don't. The whole system is anonymous.
Okay, so how does that work legally then? What do I end up with as a legal contract?
You end up with a legal contract that says you have lent money to a borrower. The borrower's identity is hidden.
Yeah, so my contract says you've lent money to borrower number 474263.
We encode it so that you don't know.
Right.
And obviously most people wouldn't want to know anyway, because it's just an anonymous system to protect both the lender and the borrower. The borrowers don't really want to know who the lenders are. So they want to know who they are as a group, but not as individuals. Now, if RateSetter falls away, if we go bust, you've still got these contracts that are intact, lenders and borrowers. At that point, that is where we would need to effectively open up the whole thing and say, in extremis, you, Mike Bannerman, have got these borrowers, and if you want to go around and talk to them, please do. In practice, it's not going to happen like that, because the FCA require, quite rightly, a
fallback provider agent.
Well, what's called a runoff plan. So our plan at RateSetter, and we'd actually want to go further, because typically what suits everybody is to say, well, don't worry, let's have a backup servicer, which
in my view is
how the world works. People are being encouraged to pass the buck.
Yeah.
My view, as it stands, this is what RateSetter has already done, is that the peer-to-peer lender should be required to have enough reserves to be able to run off the loan book. So if we stopped writing new business, we should be able to sit here. It wouldn't be a particularly exciting job, but sit here for 5 years running off the book.
So I know the people who did that for Landsbanking in the UK as I was doing a gig with them, and it blew up, and they did sit around for 5 years and get bored, and every week they'd let one of them go because they were less than required, but they ran off the loan book in precisely that fashion. And going back to the episode with Christian of LendInvest, in the show notes / blog with that, I wrote a little bit then about the risk as I saw it, and that there's a differentiation between principal risk, where by and large one doesn't have principal risk or shouldn't have principal risk, although I think sometimes a little bit might creep in, on peer-to-peer platforms, versus agency risk. And you've got an agency risk because the platform is doing something for you, if only servicing all these cash flows and that kind of thing. And how that's addressed, again, just in terms of my informal reading of the websites last week, still tends to vary even amongst the good boys.
Yes, it does.
No, nothing wrong with that.
No, it's fine.
Just the way it is.
Absolutely fine. And I mean, the only thing that really matters is the intentions of the management team and whether they're good or bad, in my view. Yes. I mean, I think the intentions of a business are as important as the legal niceties, because that is what drives a business.
Well, it comes back to what we're talking about, corporate finance. You know, the general culture of the corporate finance department is not to sort of screw your clients over, because it's a very short-term strategy and you'll be remembered for a long time to come. So I entirely buy that. I think the only scepticism I have about that is that thinking on the 5 and 10 year view, you can't be sure in this very changeable world that the nice guys here today will be here in 5 years' time. You may have all been uberified in the meantime and a bunch of sharks running it.
Absolutely.
Not you, the platforms in general.
Of course, you know, that's the point of the law, is that the law is not necessary most of the time, but you need it when things go wrong.
Yes, exactly.
But we've thought long and hard about what is a sensible structure for this business, that in extremis, if things go wrong, what is the end game? What's the, not the end game, because that sounds like it's a target. What's the end resolution?
Yeah. Or what are those things, living wills, that big banks are supposed to do, which is probably...
Living wills. I'm very interested by all of that stuff.
I think it makes a lot of sense on the scale that you guys are at. I'm just a bit sceptical that the likes of a Citigroup, a living will isn't just a, you know, feast day for sort of consultants and lawyers and there's 5 million documents.
Of course it is. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars of fees later, they're no further down the track.
No, exactly.
And what will happen... And one also needs to remember that in life, everything's fine until there's a crisis and then it all goes wrong.
Yeah. When it hits the fan, it hits the fan.
Whatever you have in place will be wrong and all that good stuff. So, I mean, on that point, this is where I actually think PDP, well, I would say this, but I do actually think it has some inherent strengths, at least the way that we think about it at RateSetter, which is that the beauty of our system, perversely, is that it does not give any guarantees or any promises to anybody.
Yeah.
Everything is on a best efforts basis. It's just saying, we will do this on a best efforts basis. As soon as you start trying to give guarantees in life, that becomes expensive. And the danger is you break that promise, which of course is what happened with the banks. And people don't forget that. So we don't promise anything and we don't guarantee anything. So therefore, it actually has a flexibility to it, this system. It's putting basically lending and borrowing, in my view, on a very honest basis, which is saying... You're a lender, you want to earn a return on your money. If things go well, you will. If things go wrong, you might lose. Whereas there is a misunderstanding, I think, across a lot of people that there is such a thing as a sort of safe bank. And banks, certainly for the last 15 years or so, have been quite undercapitalised and you could argue have not been particularly safe.
Undercapitalised or over-leveraged, depending on which side of the coin you want to look at, of course.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not... anti-bank, and that's a whole separate discussion, and I'm certainly not raging against them. I think that they're trying bloody hard to rectify some of the things that went wrong. But the regulator, my take on the whole macro regulation is that the regulators are saying, if you want to call yourself safe, you need to be safe. At RateSetter, we don't purport to be safe. We focus on value, not safety.
I must retweet that one for you next week. You focus on value, not safety. It's a very good way of putting it. And actually, as I say, it's a completely different thing entirely, but I don't actually believe the regulators are doing the right thing as a whole around the world. I think it's a disaster. What they're continuing to perpetuate in banking is extremely complex and expensive barrier to entry, cost of being in business, which means that the banks are so unprofitable that several years later they've got to be taking risk to make the money, because no sensible business can cover all the kind of costs. You know, the last time I was doing a gig at a bank, in one division alone they were spending in 1 year $100 million on regulation. Now, you will understand, as a capitalist, that's got to come from somewhere. Someone's got to make that profit. And the only way you can make profit, you know, due to excess capacity, unlike in coal industry or shipbuilding where people go bust. Anyway, another thing entirely. Coming back to this, how the process works, Ridian, so I've transferred my £1,000 from Halifax, I would see it into your platform, and then it sits in this sort of Barclays account, and then in the complex process we'll come on to in a minute, it ends up with a borrower. In simple terms, what contract do I get? Now, if I deposit money at a bank, I don't think I get a contract, but if I go and buy an equity, they will send me some settlement thing saying I've bought 1,000 BP
Correct.
Shares.
So let's talk about those three different things. A deposit, a loan and an equity. So when you lend via RateSetter, you, or peer-to-peer, you will get a loan contract. Yeah. You will own a contract with a borrower. The requirement of the borrower is to repay you. And that contract will either be regulated or not. I mean, this may be detail that you don't need to know, but you know, the consumer contracts will be under the Consumer Credit Act.
Yeah. So is it the consumer for the lender or the borrower side of it?
The borrower.
Right, okay.
The small business loan contracts may not be regulated and so forth. But basically, you have a loan contract. When you buy a share, you get a contract. Well, you don't get a contract. You have a share certificate. That's what you have. with rates set to you own a loan contract. If you buy a share, you own a share.
Yeah.
If you give your money to a bank, you're lending the money to the bank. That's what you're doing. They call it a deposit, but actually you're lending your money.
Yes,
you are an unsecured creditor of the bank.
Exactly. And actually, you don't get a contract. I was having a conversation with an ex-FD of various PLC-type banks a year ago, and he was saying, oh, what a load of rubbish Bitcoin was and blah, 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 and you know, all this anonymizing stuff. And I said, well, actually, at least there's some proof of ownership there, because actually, I'm not quite sure, and he didn't actually know, what the proof is that you gave the money to the bank. Because in the old days, I'd have a pile of bank statements at home, and I could say, oh, Mr. Banker, look, I did put £1,000 in, here's your statement that says so. But these days, it's all online, and you know, it's disappeared. And anyway, it's slightly by the way, but in the particular case of peer-to-peer, then I've got a loan contract, anonymised, as we've discussed.
But not necessarily anonymised. It doesn't need to be anonymised, as an aside. I mean, as in, I could see a situation where a peer-to-peer lending platform had a lender that was named and a business.
Oh, right. So what about Data Protection Act, then? I thought...
That's why it's relevant for consumer.
I see the consumer. OK.
Yes.
So exactly, on the corporate.
I mean, Vodafone borrows from lots of borrowers.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't mind...
They don't mind their name being known.
OK, so we've got the cash flows. We've got some understanding of the legal things. We didn't have time to go into the details of it all blows up and de-anonymising it and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think the key point there is that we are required to have a run-off plan. We are required to have a sort of an equivalent of the living will.
Yeah, exactly. And different platforms do have different approaches. And then some say, oh, we'll just transfer our asset servicing, if you want to call it that. We'll transfer our asset servicing function to another one and they'll asset service for you.
Correct.
If we're bankrupt.
We rate setter want to take more responsibility and actually not have just a backup servicer. We would like to actually have a run-off plan.
Right. So coming back to you guys at RateSearch wanting to have more responsibility and you waking up at 3 o'clock one morning and thinking, oh, provision fund. So just going back to the history of that, how did it happen then? Did you suddenly wake up and think provision fund? Or?
Well, what the motivation here was to create a marketplace where interest rates are set. That's why it's called RateSetter. And that's what I found personally interesting was the idea that as a normal person, you don't have access to markets where very fundamental things like interest rates are set. I don't understand why you don't as a consumer, but somebody very senior has said that should not be exposed to the people. So I saw no reason in the internet age why you can't have access to the interest rate markets.
And just pressing pause there, for anyone that doesn't understand the mechanism of that, and that probably includes me in getting the details, we're going to come on to that in a couple of minutes' time, what it means to set the rate and where that comes from. But anyway.
What people should understand, every single day, every single second in the city or in Wall Street or God knows where, interest rates are being set in a market. The participants in that of that market...
Well, being fixed in some markets due to the LIBOR.
Indeed.
That's another story entirely.
Indeed, that's another story. Interest rates are being set, but the participants in that market are institutions. What we are trying to do is to allow consumers to participate in that process. So that was the motivation behind RateSetter. In order for that to kind of take effect, where we want our customers to say, I want to lend for this long and I want this rate, with a focus on interest rates of what they think their money is worth for that term, we had to get rid of the rather inconvenient fact of credit risk.
I see.
So we then thought, well, how do you get rid of credit risk or at least mitigate it as much as possible so that people don't need to focus on credit risk, they just need to focus on
supply and demand
and rates. So I came up with the idea of the provision fund.
Right.
But you can see what it's
The other way around.
It's the other way around.
It wasn't as I imagined that one day you're sitting there thinking, oh, how do I do something different from Zopa? Oh, yeah, we should have a provision fund. And, of course, then we can get into all the sort of tax complications of blah, blah, blah.
So we look at things, I would guess, probably quite differently.
Okay, so the provision fund is basically there to
take credit risk out of the mental equation.
So then it's just buying and selling and
money, depending on a term.
Right. Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, and it's very interesting because it was the other way around from what I assumed / guessed. So let's just take the provision fund as a black box, which works completely, and put that to one side. So basically, for the sake of argument, I'm lending through your platform, and let's say this works 100% over the next 100 years. I know you're not allowed to say the FCA and that, but I've just said it. Anyway, it's an assumption as a thought experiment. It works perfectly well for the next 100 years. So we put it to one side. So basically, as if I was lending to AAA borrowers, so I'm not really worried about any credit whatsoever, just in terms of slicing up the machine into little bits. So then maybe it's a good time to explain to me, in words of one syllable, because I'm not very sharp, how this rate setting thing works then.
It's an order-driven exchange, like the stock market. So it has bids and offers, effectively.
Yeah.
And a match is done when either the lender accepts the borrower's rate or the borrower accepts the lender's rate.
So, for example, I could come to your site and I could say, I want 10% and I want the best credits only. And that my bid would sit there, or offer, whichever way around you're talking about it, would sit there for ages because it would never get hit given where interest rates are.
Correct. And you can't, on our site, you can't come and say you want the best credits because you all get the same credits.
You'll get the same credit, absolutely. Yeah. So then someone else comes along with a 9, someone comes an 8, someone comes a 7, someone comes a 6, someone comes a 5.
And the borrower will always be matched with the lowest lender rate.
Okay, and on the other side then, the borrowers say, oh, I'll borrow if someone's going to lend to me at 1%, and someone says I'll borrow if it's 2, and someone says it's 3, someone says it's 4, and someone says it's 5, at which point the two 5s meet up, and then that's the price.
Correct.
For that, trade.
That is the price of the underlying interest rate.
Yeah.
The borrower pays fees and a risk premium on top of that interest rate.
On top of that, I see.
So let's take the example. The lender is saying, you come to RateSetter and you say, I want to lend for 5 years and I want 5.5%. The next lender may come along and say he wants 5.6, 5.7, 5.8, and they sit in a queue. You may see that a borrower is looking to borrow at 5.4%. The borrower is not paying 5.4%. He's paying 5.4% plus some fees, the fee that goes to RateSetter, plus the fee that goes to the provision fund. So the all-in cost to the borrower might be, I don't know, 7.5%.
Right.
But what you're competing on with the lender, that's what sets the underlying interest rate.
I see. So actually the borrower might come along and say, look, I'm happy to borrow at 8%. And let's say for the sake of
argument... our computer back solves and works out what that means in interest rate terms.
Exactly. Let's say your computer, let's keep it simple. Let's say you charge the lender 1% per annum or something like that. And his credit rating means you've got to take 2% per annum to stick in the provision fund to make him effectively high credit rating, So that's an order-driven exchange. Okay, so, and then you've also got a thing, because that's too complicated for people like me, where I just hit the button and say, whatever, which is about 5%.
The whatever rate.
Yeah. The whatever rate.
Yeah. No, we have something called market rate.
Yes.
And in life, 90-95% of us are passive in life.
Yeah. Or very busy these days.
Or very busy. That's the nature of things. So what typically happens in all markets, whether this be the stock market, commodities markets, you name it, whatever markets, you have an active 5 or 10% of people that set prices and are active in it. And then you have a more passive people that will just take the market rate. So we've set up a mechanism that allows people to just go, I just want the market rate. Now, one of the reasons why I think it's interesting, why I like markets, and why I think it's interesting that we are creating a decently sized lending and borrowing business while not being involved in the setting of interest rates, is that it fundamentally changes the relationship with our customers in a positive way. In that if you're a bank, the bank says to you, you can get 2%. That's what I'm going to give you. It's a hierarchical relationship of, this is what I'm going to give you. We're saying, we just host a marketplace in which you, as lenders and borrowers, agree what is the right rate. So we're facilitator as opposed to sort of saying what rate we can give you. And that sort of changes the relationship, I think, in that when banks say to savers, you were getting 2%, you're now getting 1%. That's an abrasive relationship. Now, it can work the other way around, which is the bank says, I'm going to go from 2 to 3. And you think, oh, God, I like that bank.
It's a relationship of power, though. I'm saying, if you want to borrow from us, it's 7%. And I'm telling you, as opposed to it's the other way around. You come to me, I'm a platform, and you say, if you can do 7%, I'll borrow at 7, but I'm not going to borrow at 8. Oh, okay, that's fine. I'll let you know whether it works.
It gives a sense of empowerment to savers and borrowers because they are the ones that are driving the rates.
It's interesting. Just reading through the platforms, I hadn't particularly got these sort of different flavours of the motivation. And I entirely see that, and this comes back to your comment about 2002, you've had a lot of time thinking about this, and there's some deep philosophy behind it, which is very coherent. Okay, so as you say, the majority of the people in the majority of the market just hit the bid. So if I ring up some stockbroker and try and sell my BP shares today, it'll be at whatever. I'm not going to try and sort of beat the market and say, oh, I'll sell it if it's 5.65, but not if it's 5.64 or something like that. And you've got a small number of participants in markets who are active. Now, the one thing I haven't really seen mentioned at all in coverage of P2P is that this does open the door in the UK P2P. I'll clarify this in a minute. This does open the door for a certain amount of strategy or tactics or game theory or something like that. Now, I'll give you an example of what's at the back of my mind so you can convert this into sort of proper English, as it were. I read a blog article on Funding Circle a little while ago, which they tweeted about. And, oh, look, here's a happy borrower, and here's a happy borrower's story. I thought, this is interesting. I read the article. It was a very good article. The borrower was happy and all that kind of thing. But what kind of didn't really leap out of the article as such, and certainly wasn't focused on in the social media aspect, was basically a game theory kind of thing. So this borrower put his bid in, or offer. I mean, I always got very confused, even when I was running fund management, between bids and offers. Anyway, it's all relative. He put his bid in or offer. He wanted to borrow money at, let's say, 13%. I thought, hung around a few more days, and it came down to 11. Oh, I'll have that then. And so he takes the 11. Now, that's kind of interesting. So from a lender perspective, if I'm lending to these platforms, or at least the platform...
Or through these platforms.
Through these platforms.
Not to these
platforms. No, correct, yes, you've picked me up right. If I'm lending through the platforms in the kind of ones that you're talking about, not the more marketplace ones where I'm picking individual assets, but as you're talking about, then, you know, I just hit the bid and that's it. But on the other side, the borrowers, there's a real strategy game going on. Well, certainly in the case of this one that was going through Funding Circle, he waited a few more days and he got 2%. And hey, that's a hell of a lot of difference, you know? So I'm just wondering when you're going to get little consultancies coming along saying, oh, not just coming back to the government saying, you know, that they shall have a portal so the banks are going to direct SMEs they turn away. But there's a whole game theory thing here, isn't there then?
What, where you're going to have people advising borrowers how to borrow?
Just this little fantasy, you know, consultants crop up all over the place. But, like if you've got an insurance agent... So I rather have the view that everything changes and get re-intermediation. So if I'm trying to go and get an insurance or health insurance, I'll come to some insurance agent. I say, look, you know more about health insurance than me. Just go and sort out, get the best rate for me. He will go away and do it. And I'm just wondering.
There will be re-intermediation. That's life. And it goes back to the fact what we spoke about 10 minutes ago, which is that 90% of people are passive in life and busy and want to just deal with other things in life. And 10% of those that are actually going to go and find out what the best thing to do is. So we're not going to change that pattern of behaviour. The only thing to me that matters is that that 10% is able to do this. That if you want to...
You're giving people the choice.
Yeah. That's what's fundamentally changed in the last 5 years is that with the emergence of peer-to-peer lending is that if you are a saver that wants to be more active with their money, you now have that choice. You can go and lend it on these platforms. People, you couldn't. Now, that's not to say that we're going to change behaviour such that investors, savers, lenders are going to be more active with their money. They may still choose to give it to consultants and fund managers and all that, but at least they have the choice.
Yes, and why I'd mentioned UK before was that Peter Renton's done some very good podcasts, particularly in the last year, with a number of active investors in the States who've been investing their money in Prosper and Lending Club for years. And they've been very busy gaming the whole thing and going through APIs and coming up with strategies and saying, oh, I want Northern California borrowers who are in the sort of retail sector or, you know, all that kind of fund management.
Well, I can see that that can happen. Yeah, absolutely. And they'll talk about outperformance and alpha and all
this stuff, and they'll try and get paid for that.
I won't comment on whether I think that's going to be at scale possible. I think it probably is. And I suspect in inefficient, early, nascent markets, you can add huge performance.
Your intuition is very good. So as I understand, the history of people who invested for several years in the States, as on Peter, who was on the show before Christmas, on his podcast, a number of the early investors, and including Peter, really beat the market.
Right.
What happened in that kind of situation where, you know, it isn't the rate setter you're talking about, the lending club decides what the rates are, sticks it on the platform, people bid and whatever, is that the people in lending club got better at arbitraging the algorithm, so the mispricing, as it were, disappear. So at the end of the day, the pricing got better. So precisely as you say, over time, this ability disappears. Coming back to the UK, we talked about peer-to-peer models at the beginning. There are a spectrum of models, and this is all very good. It just means that people need to know what they're looking at.
Indeed.
At the one end, we're talking about rate setter, and you kind of, just again, simplifying it, try and take, to the best extent you can, the credit out of the equation. At the other extent, you've got a Funding Circle, whose business model is deliberately to leave in the credit there. So you can go to their site and say, I'm going to invest in C2s this week.
Absolutely.
Last week I invested in B4s or something like that. Now, in their case, what that means is that if you go to their site, you will see a much wider range of interest rates, and I suspect you will see much more opportunity at the moment for gaming or fund management or whatever you want to call it, compared to coming to you guys, where your one-year rate isn't going to change from 4.9 today to 7.3 tomorrow afternoon.
There are two sort of models, if you like, emerging in the UK, and it's, dare I say, sort of the rate setter model, the one that we've pioneered, and then the sort of Funding Circle model. And I think it's great that there's these two things and we're very relaxed about talking about their differences. I think the Funding Circle model, there's a very good opportunity for investors to outperform, to actually, you know, choose good loans, have a strategy, and they'll get tremendous value. I mean, there'll be some ups and downs, but there's fantastic value to be had. Rate setters' focus is different because we're motivated by the idea of a kind of a market where interest rates are set. And so we've effectively mutualized or neutered the credit risk. So we just think about the world slightly differently. I think ours is, in some respects, a simpler product for some people. But Funding Circle gives you the potential for more value, arguably. So, you know, both have pros and cons.
And it's different demographics. I mean, you know, if it was my mum, I'd say, look, just go to Zopa/RateSetter or whatever. Whereas if it was some sort of city savvy person who's got too much money and too much time on his hands, they might as well sit around and play with sort of Funding Circle's API all day. Give them a hobby. And I'm sure they probably outperform, albeit risk-adjusted, who knows?
Indeed.
Moving on to the bit of the whiteboard that we'd sort of just left as a black box previously, which is your innovation of the provision fund, which is very interesting. Now, again, just trying to drill beneath the metaphors. One of the metaphors that I'd seen around this, and it may not be a metaphor, it may actually be the literal truth, is that the provision fund is owned by the lenders. And I was interested in what that amounts to. And the reason I was mentioning it is, again, reading the various ones, I saw on Wellesley's site that their model, and again, people got different models, nothing wrong with this, their model is that the provision fund is actually owned by a separate company for some reason, I can't remember, and there's some reason, legally reason, that borrowers have to kind of apply to that to get the money out, and because otherwise it'd be some guarantee or anyway, just without trying to confuse it as I have already. So how does your provision fund work? So I've put my £1,000 in. Do I suddenly own a tenth of a basis point of your whole provision fund?
No, because it's a trust, so you don't have shares in that trust. You become a beneficiary of that trust or potential beneficiary of that trust.
So there is an arm's length principle there then.
So while you are lending through RateSetter, that qualifies you to be a beneficiary of that trust. Once you go away, if you withdraw or you leave the system, then you are no longer a beneficiary of that provision fund trust. Yes, it's owned by our lenders and it's there to protect them. And that's an interesting thing. I mean, this opens up some other things to talk about, namely that the fund is there. One, it's not a guarantee. And going back to our earlier conversation about making no promises, no guarantees and being completely...
Not only are you not allowed to, you didn't want to in the first place.
Because it's not the motivation.
Yes.
And so the fact we're not allowed to is absolutely fine. And I think it's good not to give guarantees. Also, I like the idea of these funds, these peer-to-peer funds, in their self-sufficiency, or their, at least their purported self-sufficiency. Because one of the things that's often talked about, I don't know whether to even talk about it because it's so dreary in a way, is this lack of FSCS protection.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of deemed to be the kind of Achilles heel of peer-to-peer lending. The reality of it is just that the FSCS, we've just never had a conversation.
And for the listeners that who can't remember what FSCS stands for, that's the thing that the sort of government basically
can't
says,
remember or never knew in the first place.
Yeah, or don't really care unless they actually used it with Landsbanking, as I mentioned earlier. That's the thing whereby government guarantees up to 85 grand in bank accounts these days.
So, you know, we just never had the conversation with the FSCS. I mean, my instinct is that at this stage, we wouldn't necessarily want to have that protection.
I think I saw something on your website somewhere which implied that actually there's a cost to being in the FCS.
Of course there is.
Which almost implied to me that maybe if I wasn't a bank, I could join it, like the London FinTech Podcast could join it, and I pay my $1 million per day or whatever to them, and they guarantee the listeners or something. I thought it was you had to be a bank or something.
There are two FSCSs. This is of some interest maybe to your listeners. There are two FSCSs. There is deposit insurance. If you are a bank, you pay a tiny percentage of your liabilities, which in the case of a bank is your deposit, into this giant fund, and that gives you cover in the event that there's a problem. Yeah. Now, actually, normally the problems when they come are so big that the fund's not big enough.
The tsunami that comes along.
Absolutely.
Your swimming pool is a bit small.
My understanding is that in the last crisis, the FSCS was not big enough to cover the problem. So my general macro view on banking is that you can never have enough capital.
Correct.
To prevent
Absolutely.
The tsunami.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then for many, many years, you have too much capital. Yeah, so. The fund, we don't target anything because it's just, we just let the system find its level.
Yeah.
But the FSCS has a cost, is the point.
Okay, so the FSCS, okay.
Of course it does, because it's a form of insurance. Yeah.
So on your provision fund, you estimate, you model anticipated credit losses, and then you've got coverage in the fund off the top of my 149% of those, or whatever it was the other day when I looked it up, which is well above those expected losses. And of course, risks are another thing entirely. We didn't have time for it on this episode, but you know, the risk will vary over time and all that. One curiosity about this provision fund has a trust, and I will be a beneficiary if I'm lending through the platform, but I won't when I stop. I'm just curious, so over time, if you are very conservative, as you like being, nothing wrong with that, nice and simple, and the provision fund builds a higher and higher and higher and higher surplus, who owns that then, whoever's there at the time? And I'm thinking, of course, because going back to building societies and golf clubs and everything that started being privatised 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. In the future, when your provision fund's got $1 billion of excess, some VCs might come along, or PE firm, come along, buy you up, and then just sort of blow up the provision fund or take it.
I'll tell you exactly. The structure is that the lenders own it. It is not our intention to build up a orphan pot, as we would call it, because I think it is complicated, and I think the wave of demutualisations in the building society and the insurance sector were actually administratively quite complicated. But that is the legal situation at the moment, and it's not a major issue of a concern of me at the moment, because I cannot see there being a surplus for so long that I think it's a moot point. But it is something that some of our lenders are very attracted to, is the long-term prospect that actually you might be able to benefit from that surplus if it emerges. I mean, we take a view of sort of 7, 10, 20 years in terms of that fund.
Which goes back to the pre-Big Bang world of when everybody did have a long-term interest there. You know, members of a building society wanted to keep it going. Building society directors were paid very little. And that was a very stable system, as opposed to this sort of daily mark-to-market, dog-eat-dog capitalism. Let's try and get every piece of cash out of everything we can every day.
Indeed.
I think we've gone through the main things here, how it works, how the legals work, how the provision work, how you're taking credit out, others are leaving credit in, and the whole game theory and the ability to sort of play the system, as it were, and all that kind of stuff. So I think we've got into a lot of detail in the scope of the time available and without the whiteboard. So just before we wrap up, Ridian, where is RateSetter going today, and what are you guys hoping to achieve?
We're growing very nicely.
You're growing very rapidly, or being too modest.
Yeah, no,
very well. I agree.
Yeah, no, I think rampant growth in financial services can be, one needs to do it in a measured way and always be asking the question as to, you know, where's the growth coming from and can we manage it and so forth. So we're doing it in a measured way. We probably could grow even quicker, but yeah, we are doubling, more than doubling every year. In January, we grew 30%. In January, we did 44 million of lending matched through RateSetter, which is a record in UK peer-to-peer by some distance. So as a platform, in 2014, we did just shy of 300 million, which was the largest in the UK.
Just on volumes, because there is a confusion in the marketplace around this, and some of the listeners won't have bothered to get their head into the detail. There's, off the top of my head, three ways that you can measure volume. You can measure volume since inception, which just kind of shows how long you've been going in a way. You can measure the total number of deals you've done, as it were, which is, for the sake of argument, let's say I lend $1 million every day, then at the end of the year my volume would be 365, or you can measure the kind of size of the loan book. And I think the first one about since inception is a bit silly, so people didn't do it, but in terms of...
Well, they do, actually.
Do they? Oh, okay, well,
actually, to be honest with you, the whole industry hinges on that, yes. And I think it will continue to do so for a little while, because it is the biggest number.
Right.
But I agree with what you're probably coming on to say, which is that it will fade in time.
Okay, so that was going to fade in time. But then you've got the difference between the volumes, which will tend to be higher for people doing more short-term business, and then the average loan book size.
Yep.
I hope I'm not confusing people completely, but these numbers can be very different. So taking the example of I lend $1 million every day for 365 days in a row, then my deals I did this year is 365 million. But let's say you do one deal of 10 million for 1 year. Well, actually, your loan book has been 10 times mine all the time.
I think there are three numbers. I think there's the historic number of cumulative. I think there is monthly origination, which is probably the one that indicates which platforms are growing and which are stalling. And then there is outstandings, which I think reflects, as you say, as much the type of loans as it does, you know, the original size.
Anyway, in the case of RateSetter, on all three measures, you're doing really well because they're all going up.
Indeed. I mean, we are the biggest in terms of origination, monthly origination. So things are going well, and we're investing heavily as a business, so we're in people above all.
Yeah, and so you're in a number of rooms on this floor now, and also you've got quite a large room in Australia called RateSetter Australia.
That's right, and I'm sure, Mike, if you wanted to pass by, then they'd be delighted to be on the London podcast from Sydney.
I was reflecting this morning on the challenges of managing growth and how it's always exciting, expanding around the world and all that kind of thing. And I was recalling back in the day, in the 90s, my buddy who ran credit to Climewatts, he was given responsibility for climate events in Australia, and he came along excitedly on a sort of Friday afternoon to my office, and we just shut the door and have a chat rather than doing any work. And I said, oh, it's great, Mike. You know, I said, what's that? He said, oh, I'm in charge of KB Australia. Oh, fantastic. And that's really good. I said,
go down this. Oh, yeah, I'm going every 3 months. Wonderful, love the place. Stop off at Singapore and all that kind of stuff. Oh, fantastic. You're going to love that. You know, about 3 years later, I'm off to Australia again. Like, it's so far, it's so far away.
The key thing about Rated Australia is that it's not run from here at all. Yeah. It's run by, you know, the CEO, Daniel Fogo, and his management team there, and it is an independent business in that way.
And they can come here every other time, you can go there every other time.
Yeah, and Pete Behrens is on the board of Rated Australia.
So you're doing really well. There's lots of stuff we don't have time for, which is people are pointing about anyway, in terms of the fairly soon stuff's going to be ISA-able. Then there's SIPs and annuities and all these pension funds things happening. So there's a lot exciting in the industry. And if I was your fairy godmother, I'd be rather ugly-looking fairy godmother, perhaps, but what kind of wish would you want for RateSetter in 2015 for people listening? I mean, are you after sort of more lenders or more borrowers or more of both, or more brand awareness? I mean,
yeah, I think brand awareness will help, but you can't sort of shortcut that. Brand will come with trust, and trust is not something you earn overnight. So it'll just compound if we keep doing the right thing. I think 2015 will be a year when certain platforms will continue to do well and grow. I think that might be a year when some platforms
fall by the wayside
because of just the economics of this business. It's not straightforward to build a business. It's just not. And it requires a degree of scale and determination and investment. So I think we may see 2015 there being some bad news as well as good news in this space. So my wish would be that people don't get hysterical and that they look through to the underlying growth and goodness of what we do, as opposed to just pick up on the inevitable first failure and think, oh, this industry doesn't work. Because this industry does work, it has good fundamentals, and is in the long run a game changer in lending and borrowing.
Absolutely, I'd entirely agree with that as a summary. I mean, a few have fallen by the wayside so far, and I probably get sort of locked up in jail for anything that's sort of approaching advice, but certainly for the listeners, I really encourage them to stick with the top good handful rather than the ones at the bottom are having a harder time. And I think if people have got anything else out of today, then perhaps we've lifted the lid a little bit on Pandora's box and shown that although it sounds simple at a metaphorical level, actually there's a lot of complexity that goes on within this. And I obviously am not going to say whom, but last year I was giving a little bit of advice to a company, and they said, oh yeah, we're going to do that, you know, debt things. Debt's really easy. Debt's no, oh dear. You know, I try to say it's not anyway. No, it's really simple. It's not as simple as it sounds. I think, you know, one of the skills of the leading businesses is that they've put a lot of work into it, and I can see how you've been thinking about it now 13 years, really, and they put a lot of thought into this as well. And like anything else, good golfer or whatever, it looks simple, but it's not as simple as it sounds. Good. So thank you very much for that, really.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the